Good to see you tonight. Ron, thank you for the songs, beautiful songs, especially the one we'll do for the invitation song. I think probably at least my favorite right now in my life, and probably one I'll probably want to have at my funeral one of these days, but I just really like that song number 10. I think that's the favorite one right now personally for me. Tonight, I'm going to speak for, I think, about 20 minutes, and then we will have an invitation. We'll have the Lord's Supper, we'll have announcements, closing prayer, and then Dennis will get up and start. A few men are going to get up and just kind of a short congregational meeting, letting you know what's kind of going on in different aspects of the congregation. So, announced this morning I announced this, I'd encountered an article this week that began with, "Why are so many young people unhappy?" And the writer kind of noted that it just seems that not only in this country, but there's an unprecedented high rate of unhappiness among young people in America and throughout the world, and things like the rates of suicide and self-injury and depression and mass shootings and loneliness. In fact, loneliness at all ages are higher than ever recorded. Even higher than during the Great Depression, even higher than the Second World War. And you would think, like, boy, the time to be depressed for many people might have been the Great Depression, but even higher rates than during that time. And so a lot of people are trying to put their finger on what's the issue? And some say, well, maybe it's the increased use of illicit drugs and the abuse of prescription drugs. And maybe it's constant cell phone use, is that we're connected, but we're really not connected to one another, that there's not face-to-face conversations as much anymore. And there's a lot of other things that kind of go in there. The first thing I noted is that I found it interesting that when Jesus begins to preach the gospel in the Matthew chapter 4, the statement is made that the people who are sitting in darkness saw a great light. Is that this is not the first generation that has been in darkness. I'm reminded of Acts chapter 26, 28, that when Jesus appeared to Saul on the road to Damascus, he said, "I'm going to deliver you from the Gentiles, and I'm going to send you, and I want you to preach the gospel and to deliver people out of darkness." And so Isaiah speaks of his time of many of the people there said they growled as bears and they went groaning along and they were like blind men trying to find their way through the dark because of their sins. So we're not the first generation ever to really be at times in a dark mood or just kind of a dark world, is that it's easy to be there. So it's interesting that in 1831, a man from France came to America and visited America and wrote a book about it and gave his observations about America. That is what made America great. And he said, "Americans' unique strength derived largely from their participation in innumerable non-governmental associations. Professional, social, civic, political, artistic, philanthropic, and of course, churches." This man said, "America's great strength is that Americans are involved, and Americans belong to things, and particularly Americans have faith, and Americans have churches, all sorts of churches. And that's their great strength, is they belong, they're connected, they're communal, they're community-oriented, and things like that." And a lot of that is dwindling, people have noted. Primarily since about the 1980s, a lot of things like that had dwindled, like church attendance and things like that. But not only that has dwindled, but things like getting married first and having children, that's dwindled. Today, a greater percentage of Americans are born unwed mothers, and fewer people are marrying than ever before. In fact, for the first time in our history, there are more single Americans than married Americans. And it's certainly possible to feel lonely in a marriage. People, though, are far more likely to feel lonely without a spouse and without children and than having a spouse and having children. But in the book of Matthew chapter 4, verse 4, if we were to ask ourselves, what is man's greatest need? What is man's greatest need? Some people would say food. Food is man's greatest need, or maybe that's his primary need. Jesus might disagree with us and say, yes, I know food is important, but Jesus said, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Jesus might say, there's a need you have that's even greater than food, and that is a relationship with God. That's really your greatest need. And it's kind of interesting that Karl Marx came along and he said, man's greatest need is economic. That's man's greatest need. And Sigmund Freud said man's greatest need or drive is sexual. That was his theory. And Darwin said man's greatest need, you might say survival of the fittest or just survival. That's man's greatest need, to pass on your genes to the next generation and reproduce yourself and things like that. That everything was driven by biology. And Viktor Frankl, though, in the book Man's Search for Meaning, and Viktor Frankl was a man that at age 24 goes into a concentration camp. And he is married, but his wife goes somewhere else, and he gets out, and his wife is no longer alive. And the first half of the book is life in the concentration camp, and the second half of the book is kind of what he learned from it and things like that. And he came to the conclusion that man's greatest need was meaning, that man have meaning in life. And for example, you can be poor and happy. Your greatest need is not economic. There are a lot of poor people that are happy if they have meaning. In fact, I think they're, and not only that, but you can have a whole lot of money, but if you don't have meaning, you're very unhappy. So you have passages like Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. So economic, your primary need is not economic. That need can be fulfilled and you can be absolutely miserable. In the book of Proverbs 15, verse 17, there it says this, better is a dish of vegetables where love is than a fatted ox served with hatred. So you can be poor and incredibly happy if you have meaning there. Writer also noted that you can have all the sexual partners you want and be absolutely miserable. So that's not your primary need. Hollywood would be a good example of that. So as I look at some of these things, it's interesting. A 2016 study published by the American Medical Association, Psychiatry Journal, found that American women who attended a religious service at least once a week were five times less likely to commit suicide. And common sense probably tells you the same is true for men. So you might say, why are so many people, and especially young people, depressed, unhappy, angry, etc.? Well, let me suggest to you that the following is a good recipe if you want to be unhappy. Like, how do you create unhappiness? Here's the recipe. No God, no church, that is no religious community, no spouse, no country to believe in, like you've been told the country you're in is horrible, and ultimately, no meaning. That's a really good way. That's a great recipe to create a generation that is absolutely miserable. And add to that, tell them that the world's going to end in about 12 years. They have no future. You know, there's no God. You know, you don't belong to anything. You're not married to anybody, you don't have any kids, the country is horrible, and you're all going to die soon. I mean, that sounds like just a great recipe to produce a number of depressed, discouraged people. Now, I want to go to Ecclesiastes and remind us that there are certain things that you don't have to, Cindy and myself will sometimes say, you know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel here. That is, probably somebody already has figured this out before us. Or there's probably already a program that does this. You know, there's probably already something that does this. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. We don't have time to reinvent the wheel. And so in the book of Ecclesiastes chapter 2, Solomon says, hey, I just want to tell you, here is what I did. And so he said, I explored, I sought out to find pleasure, meaning, purpose, pleasure, happiness in life. And so he says in verse 4, I went down these trails. I threw myself into things like homes, home building, home remodel, that sort of thing. Gardens and parks and vineyards. Ponds, you know. And so the whole koi pond idea and the nice little fountain in your front yard, that's not a new concept. And nothing wrong with that. But Solomon said, I just threw myself into those sort of things. Then he said, you know, possessions, flocks, herds, etc. Silver, gold, verse 8. Male and female singers, and concubines. I just gathered all the concubines I could. And then he says in verse 10, all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. For my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, Solomon says, I allowed myself to think. I allowed myself to sit down and really look at what I'm all done. My house is all done. My vineyard is all done. My orchard is all done, etc. Everything's done. The house is all decorated. Everything's perfect, just the way I want it. And I allowed myself to pause and look at it, and it struck me. None of this makes me happy. None of this gives me any ultimate meaning or significance. Then he says, it's all vanity, and it's all striving after wind. It's one big, depressing, dead end. It did not make me happy. So at the end of the book, he comes to the conclusion in verse... He basically says, don't reinvent the wheel. I went through and explored everything. I looked at everything. I looked at money. I looked at relationships. I looked at women. I looked at this. I looked at that. I looked at all the things that people say, that's going to make me happy. Career, you name it. I looked at that. And finally, here's the conclusion I came to. When all has been heard, you know, everyone's been allowed to talk and every human experience has been factored in, etc. Every book has been read. When all has been heard is, fear God, keep His commandments, because this applies to every person. And that is the only thing that's really going to give you, and Frankl's right, but he's half right. Man's primary need is meaning, but you have to clarify what meaning is that. He was right about meaning, but Solomon says it's not just meaning, it's a relationship with God that gives you meaning. That's your primary need. It's not just this vague meaning, because people can say, well, that would give me meaning, and that would give me meaning, etc. It's the only thing that's really going to give you a meaning that's going to hold up throughout your life, and hold up at the end of the day, and hold up at the judgment, and hold up in eternity. And the only thing that's going to give you meaning to go through suffering and whatever that's going to keep you afloat and the hard things of life is a relationship with the Creator. That's it at the end of the day. And the unfortunate thing is a number of our young people are being told that doesn't matter. You can kind of skip that. You can opt out of that. And my hope is, see, I'm not incredibly discouraged that so many people are unhappy. They should be. I guess what would discourage me is that we've got all these people that are ignoring God, and they're great. That would be dangerous. I think the great thing is we got a lot of people, they're not paying attention to God, and they're not happy. That's a good thing. Now, the hope is that they really think about that. And that we're out there for them and say, hey, have you thought about this? Have you thought about this? Interesting, I was at New Seasons last night. I felt like bread. We're not eating much bread. But I just said, I'm getting bread. And so I went and got one of those little baguettes. I ate the whole thing. Now, I'm not sure if that's good for me because I'm kind of looking at my stomach and kind of doing like the, is that the best thing for me? So... But butter, I just ate the whole thing in butter. Butter and the whole thing, is I did. But I was there, and a young girl said as I checked out, so what you doing tonight? And I said, well, we're having a young couple over, and we're going to talk about marriage. Well, she said, well, how long have you been married? 40 years. And she said, well, what's the secret? You gotta tell us young folks, like, what's the secret? Isn't it interesting that happiness in a marriage is now considered a secret, because I think a lot of times that was not necessarily viewed as something like mysterious or secretive or things like that. Hopefully more people will ask you things like that. So I wanted to come to a few things at the end of this. Philippians chapter 4 and in verse 13, there it says, I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. This is the idea that if you have the right why, you can endure anyhow or what. If you have the right why, if you have meaning, if you have God at the center of your life, and Paul says, hey, I have Jesus, and that means I can handle anything. And maybe another way to put that is that In the book of Luke, Jesus said, "Don't fear the people that can harm you, and don't fear the people that can kill you. Rather, fear the one who's able to, after he is killed, to cast you into hell. Fear that one." And you might say, well, how is that encouraging? How is that encouraging? The encouraging thing about that is that if you have the proper respect for God, you don't have to be afraid of anything else. And to me, that sounds like the most liberating life you could ever live, is that I don't fear anything. The only thing that I really fear is God in a healthy, good respect. But outside of that, nothing else makes me worry. Nothing else makes me nervous. I don't fear anything else. I mean, I would think that that would be a true free man, that you would be truly free if you could say that with a good conscience. You say, that's the way I really do feel. And so again, God's trying to liberate us, not put a burden upon us. Also, you don't have the freedom, and this is something Frankl wrote about, you do not have the freedom of what's going to happen to you in life. You don't have that freedom. You don't have that control. But you do have this. You always have the freedom of how you choose to react. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 18. Servants, be submissive to your own masters with all respect, even to the unreasonable. See, you may have zero control about the master you have in life. You have absolute control about how you treat him. That's freedom. Same thing as in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 1. Wives, be submissive to your husbands, even to those that do not obey the word. And then it says, basically, set the best example you can. You at the end of the day, you really have no control over what decision your husband makes for God or not. You have no absolute control over that. Here's the thing you have absolute control over. How do I handle that situation? How do I react? The same is true in chapter 2, verse 12. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you. You see, you have no control about people, what people say about you. People can say all sorts of terrible things about you that are not true. You have no control over that. You do have control over your behavior. You can keep your behavior excellent. You do have control in that area. May I suggest to you that we've been living in a time for some time that there's a huge vacuum out there. There's a huge empty space. Because people have kind of taken God so much out of the picture. And in Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 13, my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, to hew for themselves broken cisterns. Cisterns that can hold no water. And Jesus came along in Matthew chapter 11, verse 28, and he said, come unto me all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. God has the answer for the thirsty and empty soul. Another thing to consider, love. I like what someone said. Love is not a pie. And that is the idea that a pie would be you take a piece out of it and now you don't have as big of a pie. You have less of a pie. Love is not like that. And so don't be afraid of people loving other people besides you, like your mate. You want your mate to love God more than they love you. And if they love God more than they love you, it's not that they have a lesser love for you. It's they have the proper love for you. Not only that, but if there's people out there that say, I love you, but I also love this person, as a friend, that's good. See, you give your love, you got plenty of love to give. Love is not a pie like that, all right? So don't be afraid of, yeah, I'm going to love God with all my heart, and I'm going to love my neighbors and myself, and I'm going to love my spouse, but I also got to love my kids, and there's plenty of love to go around for everyone. Book of Luke chapter 16, verse 10. Something else Frankl noted in the concentration camps. The people that did not make it often and the people that fell apart were the people that had lost control of the moral hold within themselves. You would think in a concentration camp that you might get to the point like, I'm just going to give myself to any sort of sinful pleasure I want because what's left, right? It's interesting the amount of people that remained moral and sought to be good. In the book of Luke chapter 16, verse 10, Jesus said, he who is unfaithful in a little is also unfaithful in much. And the thought is that you are always free to do the right thing. No one can ever take that away from you. No matter how badly they treat you, you are always free to react in the right way and to do the right thing. You always have the freedom to do that. And you want to hold on to that freedom. You don't want to ever lose your moral hold. And that's one reason, like to the young people here, don't ever start cheating on a test in high school or whatever. And don't say like, well, this is not really an important subject and the teachers are throwing a lot of stuff on us in the other classes. And so I'm going to cheat on this test just in order to make it so I can focus on other things. Because what you're doing is, once you compromise, once you lessen your inner moral grip, there's no way to stop. And so always do the right thing, no matter what it costs you. No matter what it costs you. You might say, hey, if I cheat on this test, I'll be able to get a better grade over there. Nope. There's going to be a whole lot more to life than that particular grade, than that particular class. You got a whole lot of life to live. And so don't ever lose your moral hold. Always do the right thing, no matter how small it is. No matter how small it seems to be at the moment, do the right thing. Do the thing that God wants you to do. Because that's connected with fulfillment, meaning, purpose, happiness. It's a lot easier to live with a clear conscience than to live with a guilty conscience. Hopefully that was helpful for you tonight. My wish for every one of you is a happy life, that you enjoy life. And not only that, but I definitely believe that it's possible for a Christian to love God with all their heart, but also to love life, to love being alive, and to love the fact that I was given a chance to live and placed on such an amazing planet and have such potential. I'm reminded of something that God told Cain in the book of Genesis. Why are you angry? And I think that's a good question. Why are you angry? Because the big question may be, Cain, look at the beautiful world that you've been born into. Look at the great parents you have. Look at the life you have. Look at all the beautiful joys and pleasures of living in this life. What possible reason could justify your anger right now? Particularly, I told you to do this and you just didn't do what I told you. But that's really a good thought. Is sometimes if you find yourself getting sad or whatever, you might step back and say, hey, man, look at the life I have. Look at the creation I'm part of. The fact that God loves me and Jesus died for me. Look at the church and look at the Bible that tells me how to live and just all the amazing things. Not only that, but look at all the wonderful people that surround me. And just kind of like, hey, this is a wonderful life. And I'm going to live it to the full and serve God in the process. Let's be given the invitation and standing for that.